if you've seen this, I don't know, spoilers.
What is it? Hawksan.
1922.
Where was it made?
Denmark.
Damn. Let's do a film commentary. So if you're listening to this, if you start the movie Hawksan right now, we'll be commentating on the entire movie.
1922.
Is this one of those German expressionist movies?
Benjamin Christensen wrote the script and produced this film between the years 1919 and 1921. Actually, we just have to read the subtitle.
This rocks. This is the easiest. I'll just read the subtitles of this movie. So it was made in Germany?
Denmark. It's Germanic in.
I noticed that the Denmark government recently apologized to the indigenous people of Greenland for sterilizing them however many years ago. And it's like, okay, I mean, I think you guys are probably just doing that because United States wants to take Greenland now. And they're trying to get out in front of it and be like, we're all friends here, right?
Yeah. We didn't mean
anything by it.
Yeah. When the international community is suddenly being nice to you, it's usually a harbinger of bad things to come.
Uh-huh.
The explanation is always sorcery and evil spirits.
Yeah.
In case you're looking for answers out there in listener.
They're talking about Persia. They're talking about jinn, maybe. Wait, I can't say that word in this house, huh? This movie's scary. I'm already scared. I'm pissing my pants.
You're already fronting.
Oh my God, I'm scared.
You that elephant guy right there, there's like a kangaroo man.
Uh-huh, a zebra man.
The English scientist Rawlinson and French scientist Maspero show us pictures of evil spirits.
Kulturfolk. Alsta Kulturfolk.
Believed to have resided amongst the first civilizations.
Bilda av onda.
There's Pazuzu.
Oh, whoa.
That's the guy that the Labubu's based on, right? And the Exorcist.
They based Labubu off of Zazu?
Yeah.
I guess it does have a phonetic similarity. Labubu, Puzazu.
So do you think that William Friedkin saw this and was like, that's my guy for The Exorcist?
For The Exorcist?
I guess, was The Exorcist a book?
Yeah, it was adapted from a book.
Oh. Well, damn, there goes that theory. Fucking shit.
Wake the fuck up.
Dude, I just
wake the
cut the fuck out of my phone.
Wake the fuck up. Wake the fuck up.
Dude.
Tom's got to go to the hospital now. He died.
The fuck,
from
man?
A cut on his finger.
Look at that.
He's bleeding profusely.
The ancient Egyptians believed that high mountains surrounded land and water on all sides.
I mean, I confirm that. I can't even think.
This was made in 1922. This is already better than One Battle After Another.
Whoa. You know what? It sucks so bad. As listeners of the show may not know, but I'm in One Battle After Another.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't even seen the finished product and you were in
it. And I was in it. I'm Benicio del Toro, actually.
Not a lot of people know that about you.
Uh-huh. Well, when they tried to...
your working name.
They called me up because they wanted me to play Benicio del Toro's role as Anton Chigurh.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So you were a psychopathic serial killer that's trying to usher Leonardo DiCaprio's character through the...
Yeah.
Perils of being an old radical.
Uh-huh. I didn't get to finish One Battle After Another because on my birthday, actually, we went and saw it.
Yeah.
The IMAX projector overheated. It's funny, the audio kept going, but the movie stopped.
Yeah.
And for a brief second, I thought it was in the movie. I thought it was like a Sopranos thing, like in the final episode of Sopranos.
It was like an oblique strategy.
Yeah, I was like, okay, we're a little experimental. PTA, all right.
PTA, all right. He's getting a little.
Then after 10 seconds, I was like, all right, this is clearly a problem.
It's this place that serves onion-flavored beer.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I maybe.
Like onion-flavored beer was a problem you probably ran into a lot in the year 1200.
I'd say that's probably what a lot of the guys that worked on this film ran into in Denmark in the 20s.
Uh-huh. What's a John Darnell Devil House?
This is a book. This is a book. I'm reading some literature these days.
Oh, nice.
You know John Darnell from such films as The Mountain Goats?
Yeah.
You know The Mountain Goats, the band.
Yeah, I know The Mountain Goats.
That's him. He's a novelist, too.
Okay. That's cool. I'm happy for you. I'm happy you're reading books about devil houses.
You happy for John?
Yeah, sure.
Seems like a good guy.
Don't know anything about him. couldn't name you one Mountain Goat song.
Really?
Well, I had friends that were into them back in the day, but
don't take offense to this, but you look like a guy that'd be that way would be into the Mountain Goats.
I know, I know. No, they that was the Freak Folk era.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And by that point, I was really starting to limit my Freak Folk intake.
So you're a guy that when others zag, you zig.
Yeah.
So when Freak Folk was reaching a critical mass, you're starting to read the writing on the wall. Like, well, it's time to find something else now.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, it's the thing is...
What'd you zig to?
I zigged to Steely Dan and Talking Heads.
I'm going to have to cut this off. This is terrifying.
Well, it's so scary. And I keep peeing my pants.
We see devils stuffing the damned into large cauldrons.
Uh-huh.
They're still doing that today.
Stuffing the damned.
Bugs Bunny.
Oh, yeah.
For example.
Yeah, there's a lot of demons in this.
Yeah.
A sinner is thrown straight into the fire under one of the cauldrons. Movie making in the 1920s was so dope. Look, you could just film a photo. You just film someone pointing things out on a photo with a pencil and then...
Just telling what's in the interspersed photo. This is filmmaking.
Uh-huh. Oh, no. Walmart's calling me. That's not a good sign.
Walmart Pharmacy.
Oh, that's not a good sign at all. Because I had to get my...
I said, turn your AIDS drugs around.
I had to get
everybody saw you bleeding off that high dive.
I had to get my nose spray sent over there. So if they're calling me, that means it must not be possible. They're going to tell me, like, Terrence, the nose spray is not here. We could not get the nose spray. Oh, look, they're forcing sinners into the cauldron.
Let me tell you something.
This fucking movie is terrifying.
Let me tell you this. Back in the 20s in Denmark, if you wanted to scare the living daylights out of somebody,
yeah,
I feel like they were doing this all through the Middle Ages. It's just woodcuts of half goat, half man looking at young maidens in various states of undress.
Yeah,
that's just all. It's
yeah,
horror in this time was just slightly horny.
I'd say it always has been, right?
I think so.
Yeah, I think that's part of the.
Part of the
appeal,
the libidinal nature of
the human experience. The human condition is being terrified while also having a massive erection.
Like as you can see here, the devil's picking the witch up out of the air.
Yeah, man, movies used to be so easy to make.
German life in the past in pictures. Okay, so you weren't totally off base here. You recognize those as Germanic woodcuts.
Yeah, those are Germanic woodcuts. I'm not an expert by any means.
Milk and an axe handle.
We're going to have to turn this off because the thing is it's too distracting because it's got so much text. And so we wind up reading the whole movie and people listening to this.
They didn't get their money's worth.
I just realized, 6 minutes into this that we were recording a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Wait.
I'll cut it off
now. No, just keep it on, fuck it.
See, this, look at this. This is terrifying stuff, man.
I mean, it's when you've got a, what is a nine, what is that, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, what is an 8-pointed star called?
8-pointed star, that would be an
octagram.
And it was frequently carved into the...
Look at that guy's glutes.
I know, he's jacked.
Jacked.
He's so yoked as he watches the village burn.
Imagine the years.
Whoa, hold on a second. Witches, powders, and magic. See, titties.
Imagine the year is 1600 and you're yoked, completely yoked and bricked up, and you're watching the village burn.
Notice how the sick person's laying nude in bed. This was customary in the past. not anymore.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right.
She danced with the devil's nude in the pale moonlight.
Man. Danish. Well, you know, I don't, you know, I have a whole lot to say. I've been depressed lately.
Well, I'm going to cut the scary stuff off then if you...
I'm scared and I'm depressed now.
Well.
Why don't you just throw on a movie like,
Halloween 3, Season of the Witch?
No, don't.
We've already done that one.
No, no scary movies. Why don't you throw on a movie like Ladder 49?
Ladder 49, it reminds me of that tragedy.
Was that a 9/11 movie?
I don't know.
What about a movie like...
I love that Norman joke.
What about a movie like... what's that movie where they're fighting dragons in like the sewers?
Hoxton. 1922.
Yeah, dude. Witch ointment. I want to have my back smeared with witch ointment. Do you think the listener's asleep by this point? This is a very relaxing and sleepy episode.
Yeah, go to sleep.
Just go to sleep.
No, watch Greg Garden. They'll
ever give us $5 million and then go to sleep. I didn't get to finish one battle after another. You, of course, schlepped it across town and found another screening. So it lined up? You were able to see
I had to sit through about a half hour.
Of stuff you already saw?
Stuff I'd already seen.
Well, that's all right.
Which I didn't mind.
Huh.
I didn't mind that.
I think I'm just not going to see the ending.
You think you're just going to leave it open-ended?
You know, you said I zig where everyone zags. I think this is the case where this is the...
You're content to have just watched 75% of this movie.
No, I'm just not going to finish it.
None of your business what happens after that, is it?
Like, such a contrarian that I'm like, I think I'm just...
I think they should have just edited the movie to that point.
What I saw was what I was meant to see.
You think
cosmically?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I wasn't
meant... The projector wouldn't have went down if you were meant to see the whole thing.
If I was meant to see the whole thing, exactly. That's what I saw, and that's it.
God, I defied my destiny by buying another ticket. You know what?
Yep.
They've been trying to juice these first weekend numbers, you know? They're like, hey, go see it in 6 different formats.
Uh-huh.
They saw me coming.
They did.
They're like, oh, this fool. He probably knows what happens the rest of the movie, but he'll go buy another ticket. This other guy, he's a tougher nut to crack.
Yeah, they know.
He's probably going to sit pat, having seen 75% of it.
I was really struggling with the first hour of that movie. Really the first hour and a half. Honestly, right when that really started to turn on the movie, or turn for the movie.
Yeah.
When I stopped resisting was when... That about when the IMAX projector went out.
That's when you started getting invested.
Yeah, I mean, I was invested the whole time, and it's an amazing movie. I'm not trying to be a contrarian, like it sucks. What I'm trying to say is that everything is so bad, dude.
Yeah,
and like, I think I was going through a post surgery depression.
Yeah.
Where I was like, dude, we just die. Nothing happens after you die.
How do you know that, though? Because you were put down?
Yeah, well...
Temporarily.
Pretty much. Like, when you're...
And nothing happened.
...put to sleep, like, your brain is just turned off. So, is there really that much of a difference between that and death? Like, not really. I think you just die and the brain is extinguished. And that's the end. And I was struggling for a while with the concept that... This is all there is, and all there is a horror show. And going and seeing that movie, I was like,
Terrence, look at these guys here. They don't look like they're living in a horror show, do they? Look, just a couple of guys just enjoying the day.
Tom's referring to 3 Palestinian freedom fighters dressed.
I like how they're wearing yarmulkes to throw them off the scent.
Yeah, to throw them off the scent. Tom put on Sorcerer to Honestly, this movie is a good, although the ending is very ambiguous. We will not divulge the ending.
No spoilers. Although, yeah. I think if a film's been out since 77, you can spoil it. They've had ample opportunity to watch source.
I think it's like, what one battle after another, like, it's crazy to me the extent to which we've kind of normalized, and I'm not saying one battle after another is complicit in this, but it's crazy to me how we live under military occupation, but we don't see it as such. Like, one battle after another is like literally about people living under military occupation, which is what we live under. Like, you know, I saw that like right after Trump said he was sending in the National Guard to Portland or whatever. And
that
it's
is,
like,
that is true. I keep saying stuff like, man, I'd rather live under a military junta than this. And then it's like,
we do live. We live under a military junta.
We do. What do you, the fuck you think? Why the fuck you think they spend all that money on the military?
And now, like, what was Trump's national security directive about how, like, if you are a political extremist, if you go against the, I don't know, what was it? I had it on my phone. It was like, if you disagree with the religious heritage.
Disagree with capitalism was the funniest.
Yeah. individuals and entities can be identified by any of the following indicators of violence: anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, anti-Christianity, support for the overthrow of the United States government, extremism on migration, extremism on race.
That's, what's hilarious about that, and in a true narcissist fashion, how like every confession's a,
yeah,
you know, an admission. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's like, the only people that ever tried to overthrow the government was him.
And they're also extremists on migration, race, gender.
Yeah. It's like
hostility towards those who hold traditional American views on family. That's a really funny one.
Yeah.
Hostility towards,
like, everybody hates their family, and it's like,
yeah. Hostility towards those who hold traditional American views on religion, and hostility towards those who hold traditional American views on morality. I don't know what that is.
Here's the thing. It's too ambiguous to enforce in court. Like, you might as well just say, suck Trump off or die.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Which I think is the point, right?
I think is the greater point, but it's
I think they just want to arrest as many people as possible, and if you get, like, sort of sucked into the, you know, gaping maw of the carceral state and just disappeared, like, that's kind of the objective.
Well, if they come knocking on our door, which I'll be honest, I've had the feds knock on my door before during the Bush era, it's a mixed bag.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was a different time then.
It was, yeah.
But
what year was that? 2005.
Listen,
six.
I voted for Donald Trump. I don't regret my vote. That's all I'm going to say.
You're going to tell them that?
It's like, yes, I'm a Baptist. I am a coal miner, and hell no, I don't regret my vote for Donald Trump.
I didn't even vote in the last election.
You can't say that. You did vote in the last election. You voted for Donald John Trump.
Oh yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
Dude, I am so fucked.
What if you did that? What if you just said, look, do I hold all those views? Yes. But I voted for Donald Trump. What do you want me, what do you want me to do?
Well, okay, I'll tell this on the podcast. I was debating whether or not to tell this on the podcast because it could result in my arrest. But I've not told anybody.
Yeah, I mean, you didn't finish one battle after.
Yeah.
That could lead to my arrest.
Uh-huh. I've not told anybody this. I really hope this doesn't get me in trouble, but look, we're behind a paywall. The reason the Charlie Kirk shooting fucked me up so bad.
Yeah.
Was because, okay, on the day Charlie Kirk got shot, I had opened Twitter and I saw this video from this like Christian nationalist guy who is basically like, Charlie Kirk was a Christian nationalist, right? A white supremacist. I mean, he was a little more savvy about like trying to make the views seem palatable, but like he was a white supremacist.
Charlie's just trying to make them seem more palatable.
Yeah, I think.
Then what the hell is this other guy?
Well, this guy was a guy like
depravity.
Well, I mean, I guess this guy was maybe a little older, not He was a little older and
not as in touch.
A little more rough around the edges. Yeah, not as in touch. And it was this video from this guy and he was saying, we need to start having frank conversations with our white children about how they're superior to black people, and as a result, black people will feel jealous and want to start targeting our white children, and we need to just start having frank conversations with them about this.
Wait, he said that?
Yeah. Not Charlie Kirk, but...
the other guy...
I can't remember this guy's name now.
It was trying to... His idea was to draw black people off sides and cause them to commit violence because they would be so jealous of the white children.
Exactly, yeah.
And he said that was... He said he was hatching that brilliant plot on Twitter.
Well, it was a video. It was a video of him on some right-wing podcast. And, you know, it had hundreds of thousands of views. It's like a... It's basically... It might have even been on the Matt Walsh podcast. I mean, maybe I'm completely, like, making that up. But
so
it was...
let me get this straight. His plan was to get his white child's ass kicked by a black kid or whatever. So no, they would have pretense to crack down.
No. His plan was to... What basically the gist of it was, we need to start telling white children that they can't be fraternizing with black kids. Children.
Oh, okay. So it was just like some segregation.
It was just complete segregationist, white supremacist, like neo-Confederate skinhead shit.
Yeah.
And so I saw that right before I went to go get a haircut that day, and it pissed me the fuck off. Just like the fact that this is the reality now, that like you have to hold common court with fucking vermin. People that, like, you know, 20, 30 years ago would rightly be ostracized from society as skinhead, neo-Nazi, white supremacist pieces of shit.
Yeah.
And now it's
but
just
now you have to, common like, tacitly validate them to have, like, a spirited debate or whatever.
Or even to just not get killed by the government, basically.
Right.
Like the
which
fact
brings us to our next
like the fact that like yeah like Charlie Kirk got killed, which made it naturalized that you had to actually debate people like that. Like we should not have to debate Charlie Kirk. Like these are people that
the science is in.
They hold the
the verdict's in.
They hold beliefs that white people are superior to every other race, which I not only disagree with, I wholeheartedly reject as a way of being in the world, so much so that if you think that, I think you should be put in a dog kennel.
Yeah.
And I don't think that should be a crazy thing for me to say.
No.
That's
a
belief that, like, majority of American society at least pretended to believe
for a long
40,
time.
50 years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But now, again, it's just common, whatever. And so I saw that before I went to go get a haircut. And I was just stewing on it the entire fucking time I got a haircut. I was like, you know, some motherfuckers. And I got it, and I got back in my car after I got a haircut. And so I brought, and I opened my Twitter, and that video was still up. And I was like, dude, fuck it. And I tweeted, I was like, you know you can just shoot these people, right?
Hey, then SpongeBob interstitial card 5 minutes later.
I said, you know you can just shoot these people, right? Their chest will explode and they'll get a funny look on their face.
So you describe what an assassination would look like. 10 minutes.
Yeah. Hashtag, right as I hit send, probably, is when the bullet ripped through Charlie Kirk's neck.
Terrence, I hate to say this, but... You know, God works in mysterious ways.
Well.
You prayed for...
I know.
But he's like, no. Everything in my perfect timing. But he gave you a consolation.
I guess so. Words are causative, I guess.
Yeah.
So anyways, I got home. It's only like a 5-minute drive from my barber to the house. And I got home and I opened it up and... someone replied to that, whoever you are, thank you. Someone replied to that, was like, yo, Charlie Kirk just got shot. And I was like, whoa.
Shit. And he did the Aussies and sorry voice. Whoa.
Like, rushed to delete the tweet. Like, fucking, I was like, yeah, they're going to be knocking on my door any minute. But it's like, it's just, it's like a moment. It's not like I'm actually going to go out and shoot anybody or whatever. But like, dude, it's just a moment of frustration because it's like, we don't have to coexist with white supremacists. I'm sorry. It's not the world that I want to live in.
No. Wow.
And like, I don't know if like you should literally die if you think that, but you should live in a fucking hovel out in the middle of nowhere where your ideas have no purchase and you fucking live off of like TV dinners and like, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah, you can go be, you know, like, well, the favorite thing they like to say of people on the left is they're dysgenic. And it's like, have you guys really just looked at yourself? You're all a bunch of dysgenic freaks. Like, why are you projecting that onto other people?
Yeah, if they ever, by the way, this is a total side tangent. If they ever remade this movie, Sturgill Simpson could play him.
Dead on.
Dead on. Dead on. Sorry. Sorry to whatever. But while I was watching this movie, the entire time I just kept thinking, that's Sturgill.
That's Sturgill. That's Sturgill. It's 1977.
Again, we're watching Sorcerer, by the way. So I don't know. It's just I'm tired of fucking pretending like you have to be courteous or nice to racists.
Yeah.
Like, what? Why? When did we? I don't know, man. I don't know.
You know what it is, man. These people that have on teams like the New York Yankees and all this shit. All the people that fucking just clamored to make this guy a national hero or whatever in the days after his death. Like, those people have been holding those views for a long time, and they've just, like, force-fed everybody. Like, we're in, like, a fragile moment where down is up, up is down. People have a very tenuous grasp on reality, and that's, like, the perfect time to, like, force-feed people ideology.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? 100%. And that's what they're doing. Like, they're trying to normalize that kind of view.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be normalized. Again, we should normalize, you know, if you have that view, yeah, this is a free country. You can say whatever,
say whatever you want,
but...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, I don't...
But don't get mad when you got to meet the neighbors.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I just... I don't know, man. Just a moment of frustration on my part.
I just want to point. Yeah, it's been on your heart.
You called
me right out. You said, I'm so stupid.
I said, I'm so stupid. I do think it's funny, though, that I described the exact thing that happened at the moment it was happening. Just as a crazy coincidence. Man, I must have been tapped into some sort of cosmic.
I've seen that happen one other time. I was on we used to have to go. I had a fourth period class, we'd have to go to the community technical college to take a class called typing.
Uh-huh.
That's how old I am. I used to have to take a class called typing.
I took the typing class. And that was a tight class.
We couldn't even take it at the high school because we didn't have computers. We had to go to the technical school, the vocational school, we called it. My teacher there is a guy named Scott Pace, who briefly was a roadie for the Two Live crew. That's neither here nor there. Anyway, when we boarded the bus one time, a guy named James Bubby Snell and I were sitting in the back.
Uh-huh.
And there was like this van behind us, and like they kept beeping the horn like they were trying to get. It's like, it's a school bus. It's a one-lane road. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, they like beep. Like, I don't know. What does this people want us to do? And a guy named Chris Kinder, who was, how do I put this delicately, he was a holler guy.
Yeah.
Came up and said, I wish that fucking band would get T-boned. And right about that time, we went through that intersection. We're sitting in the back. You know, it's like open. That band rolls through that red light and gets T-boned by a truck. And we go, dude. And Chris Kinder goes, good. I was like, fuck, man. I hope they're okay. So.
Wow.
Chris Kinder was desensitized to violence, I guess, at an early age.
I had this like Apple alert on my phone come up over the weekend that was like, most Americans don't want political violence. It's it's like, I don't know, just the way that it's like political violence has now become this concept that only means one specific thing. That it,
but
that,
only one kind of person's doing it, though.
Yeah, that's what's driving me nuts. Yeah.
And it's not who they say is doing it.
Yeah. Well, also, but like, I guess I'm thinking about like one battle after another, right?
Yeah.
Or like them, which basically is just a very realistic depiction of the immigration paradigm, like the militarized immigration state.
I also like how the title's kind of like perfect encapsulation of just the exhausting nature of being on the left.
Yeah. Well, but also what I was thinking about, it's also got to be it's got to be exhausting to be on the right as well. Or at least be a fascist, right? It's like, it's never a total... I've been thinking about that. I remember Alex Avina said that on a recent episode. It's never a total victory.
That's true.
Like, they're always, like, going to be fighting.
Well, that's because they have the wrong ideas.
Yeah.
Okay,
right.
We're not... This ain't a show for objectivity. It's like, they're always going to be rejected by decent people.
Right.
And that's like kind of a, you know.
That's what drives them fucking crazy.
Yeah. Like your ideas, I hate to break this to you, if you're on the right, your ideas are never going to be correct and have purchase.
Yeah.
Long term. Right. You have some victories here. Yeah, right now you all are running shit.
Right.
But eventually, and this all cools off in a while, and who the fuck knows what kind of hell is going to be there in the interim. But one day you're going to be remembered how you deserve to be remembered.
Yeah.
And that's as a low life piece of shit.
Racist thugs with way too many guns and weapons. Yeah. Like, did you see that video of that guy? You know, limitations of an audio program, obviously. But did you see the video?
I got Roy Schneider in here. I just know.
Yeah, Roy Schneider.
Roy Schneider.
Apparently, he was really pissed off at Friedkin during the making of this movie. Him and Friedkin fought the entire movie. He didn't like the choices Friedkin made for his character. That's what he said.
I'm totally for. My God.
And this scene, they had to shoot it several times, because
the actors kept dying in the car, so they had to get. Roy Scheider was actually fourth on the call list.
I can't remember what it was about that scene. The way they shot it, like, they couldn't get the car to flip in the exact way they wanted. So finally, they just hired the best stuntman in Hollywood, and he got it in the first take.
Really?
Yeah.
I like how freaking out of budget. Probably went way over.
Oh, yeah. All the movies during this period were like this. Like, Michael Cimino is the one who famously killed New Hollywood because of that movie Heaven's Gate.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, all these movies, like, they gave the directors however much money, like, they just gave them carte blanche. They were like, make whatever movie you want to make. Like, this is, you know, it's the best era probably in filmmaking.
My God,
they just made whatever movie they wanted to make. It's a good moral, though. It's like, if things ever go south for you, just run away to South America.
That is true. It's always
that
reminds me of what our friend Evan said about
tick-borne illness. Oh man, to bring the listeners up to speed, the Sheriff Mickey Steins, I guess his motive has become a little more clear now. You referred to it as bug chasing. Basically, I think what you're saying is that he was so paranoid about what people thought of him, he was like, I'm just gonna rip the band-aid off and just go balls to the wall. I'm just gonna fucking kill somebody.
I think that's probably what it was. I think the paranoia drove him insane.
The defense, his lawyers say that it was wrong for, like, the media and the detective to characterize him as out of his mind. And it's like, I mean, the guy's clearly out of his mind a little bit, right?
But also, according to that article, Dodson, who was his lawyer before the murder, I guess, or, you know, or had at least sat through a deposition with him, was attempting to chalk his erratic behavior up to tick-borne illness. which as Evan pointed out, is something they don't teach you in law school. That's something you got to learn from Daniel.
Right.
You
know? If it's not going your way, just say your client has a tick-borne illness.
I like in that article, too, Daniel's quoted as saying before the murder that I believe he's criminally insane. And if you're in the defense now, what do you say about that? Like, this is the case that sent Daniel into retirement.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't want anything
not,
to do with
not
this
only
anymore.
Retirement, he left Whitesburg. He moved out of East Kentucky.
Yeah. But it's like, no, my guy was, you know, he just going through a tough time.
He said it was encephalitis caused by a tick bite.
And then later on in that set, I believe wholeheartedly he was criminally insane.
Isn't encephalitis just swelling of the brain?
Of the brain. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not even chronic Lyme.
Oh.
But the thing is it's very clear that everything was, like, both things can be true. It's also very clear that the judge was running a sex trafficking operation through the jail. And I mean to laugh, but like, I mean, it's just, right? Like, didn't you get that impression from that article? Like, it seems that way anyways.
I guess, which one is that? From the Mountain Eagle one?
Yeah, Dotson's comment that he has a quote that said, one of the girls... I mean, read into that what you will. But like, he was basically saying that, like
the Ben Field situation, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. But he said, I think he said, one of the girls is. I mean, I don't want to quote it out of context, but he was basically saying, because they were talking about Mullins's involvement in the case that Steins was deposed for, and Dotson made a comment about, like, one of the girls bringing forward an accusation or something like that. Like, that to me
suggested there was stuff like that going on.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, again, it's all alleged. I'm not trying to, like, besmirch anybody or smear anybody's name, but, like, Eastern Kentucky politics are pretty mobbed up.
Yeah.
But only in the, like, In the most absurd sense you can imagine. It's not like the mafia. It's not like, I don't know. People go insane and, like, shoot each other. They don't, like, have people taken out in hits.
Yeah.
Although that was probably the case, like, 20 years ago, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know, dude.
Well, but also, too, it's like, at central to that whole entire case is the fact that there were sheriff's deputies coercing women on house arrest and having sex for favors. And I don't know if that was like what if it was I don't know it seems like I don't know I'd have to look at all the facts of the case there, but it does seem as if though Mickey Steins wasn't exactly running a tight ship.
I think that's what contributed to his paranoia and, like, obsession over how the community viewed him.
Yeah.
Like, he allowed this to go on, basically.
And knew that, you know. And then that once that stuff started becoming more and more public.
Yeah. It's probably a Joe Pa situation. Like, Steins himself was probably not literally in on it. But he turned a blind eye, most likely. Like, allegedly.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Would you say that's accurate? Like,
I have no idea. I honestly have no idea. I do know that when Ty had told me that it's in that Mountain Eagle article, but he had told me that Steins had called him the night before the murder and was like talking a bunch of gibberish nonsense.
Yeah.
And that quote in the story where he said, I turned to my wife and said, the son of a bitch has lost his goddamn mind. And then he's like, what I said was actually something far worse than that.
He said, I will say that what I told the paper, what I said was far worse than what I told the papers.
But I'll stand by what's in the document.
A really funny fucking quote.
Oh, God.
Damn. Yeah, man. Yeah. Speaking of bluegrass, speaking of Kentucky parapolitics. I really don't want to pick on this woman, but I think I read the stupidest fucking book I've ever read when I was recovering. It's called Bluegrass Sons, a true crime memoir.
That's interesting. So that is presented as memoir.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Happy Chandler, who was the governor of Kentucky twice, his granddaughter wrote this book that's supposed to be a sort of setting the record straight on the bluegrass on Sally Ditton's bluegrass conspiracy book. And she, like, I guess the whole,
so she, Bluegrass Sons is supposed to do for the bluegrass conspiracy what Islam did for Judeo-Christianity. A correction.
Sure. I mean, that is one of the most confounding, bizarre books I have ever read, hands down. Because she simultaneously quotes Douglas Valentine, who, you know, people who are appropriately annoyed out will know from, you know, he's written various books on the JFK assassination and various covert actions and stuff. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, she seems to be completely unaware that she's being basically manipulated in a limited hangout by her uncle, who was involved in a CIA front, like, drug running operation.
That's her uncle, Happy Chandler.
No, her uncle. So her grandpa is kind of confusing. This is why the Bluegrass Conspiracy is a very confusing book.
Yeah.
And someone needs to redo it. I mean, it's a good book, but, like, Sally,
like,
didn't,
it needs to be in the hands of a more capable writer.
Yeah, she's like, she was just a reporter for WKYT. Sally Ditton was.
Yeah.
When she wrote The Bluegrass Conspiracy, it was published in 1990. There's a few problems with it. She was a reporter for WKYT, so she's not a historian. She's also not noited, really. Yeah. She was just, like,
not particularly a good writer.
Not even really a good, right, not even a great writer. And so she, But she was a pretty good journalist.
Yeah.
And so,
like a news reporter, like a TV reporter.
A TV, yeah, right, yeah. Exactly. And but so she's kind of just thrown into this thing where she was obviously given a whole bunch of you know, documents and sources and stuff, but, like, didn't quite know how to, like, connect all the dots or put them into a larger historical context. And so that book is really maddening and bizarre in itself, Bluegrass Conspiracy. It's still really good. I mean,
one of the things I hate about books that, like when somebody gets, like, good scoop, but they can't really translate it into, like, a good cohesive narrative.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a sucker for, like, dumb little, like, musician memoirs. And there's this one about Pimp C. It's like the life of Sweet James Jones. And there's all kinds of, like, good nuggets in there. Like, one,
yeah,
he was drinking lean because he was self-medicating because he was schizophrenic, which is, like,
really?
Yeah. Which is, like, man, that's a crazy thing. But it's just in this, like, it's just written so poorly. And, like, it's got all kinds of good nuggets like that. But, like,
yeah.
But, like,
well, the Aaron Chandler Bluegrass Sons is, believe it or not, even written even more poorly than Bluegrass Conspiracy. And she is an awful, I hate to be mean, because she seems very nice. I've watched interviews with her. She seems like she's got her heart in the right place, but she's a terrible interviewer. Yeah. And it doesn't help that she knows all the people involved in this and is, like, kind of trying to cover for them a little bit because they're her family members.
Yeah.
But, like, it's also written as a, like I said, a setting the record straight of Bluegrass Conspiracy because she calls it ill-informed and whatnot. Yeah. It's like, so Sally didn't write The Bluegrass Conspiracy.
So what she's doing is she's trying to actually, and slides in more juicy nuggets while trying to run interference for her friends and relatives that were involved.
Yeah, and in the process, muddies the waters even more, provides zero additional evidence. Yeah. Because she gets to interview the main guy, one of the main guys behind the Bluegrass Conspiracy. I'm just calling it the Bluegrass Conspiracy because nobody fucking wants to name what actually happened.
Yeah. This was the backstory for Cocaine Bear for the uninitiated.
Yeah, the yeah. Cocaine Bear story. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So where Bluegrass Conspiracy started, Sally Ditton's book, this is really fucking creepy. On September 11th, 1985.
Which is the same day, if I'm not mistaken, that George H.W. Bush gave a speech, right?
Yep. That very day, in fact.
Yeah.
This guy, Drew Thornton, fell out of the sky and landed on a farm somewhere in, I want to say,
Tennessee,
like,
right?
Tennessee, yeah. And everybody always points this out, but he was wearing really nice Italian loafers.
Gucci's. Yeah. Horse bed, no doubt. Yeah.
I mean, he was like a Kentucky blue blood. All these guys were. They were all raised very wealthy, but they all went to military academy. They all served in like either Marines or Special Forces of some kind. Drew Thornton had been piloting an airplane, and there's a lot of fucking conjecture as to what actually happened, but the official story is that he was being chased by customs. If you actually go back, and Sally did do this, apparently customs denies that they were even chasing him that night, so it raises a lot of questions as to who was chasing him and why. But the official story is that he was flying tons of cocaine into the United States on a Cessna flown out of Florida, and as he passed over North Carolina, he started throwing massive amounts of cocaine out the doors. And
this is Ray Liotta's character in Cocaine Bear.
I guess so. I've not actually seen Cocaine Bear.
Okay, yeah.
Is it good?
Yeah, I think it's pretty funny.
Okay. And that's based on a true story, by the way. A bear did find a massive kilogram of coke and did it all, and his heart exploded.
Yeah.
Which really...
And she now lives just down the road here.
That sucks, man. What, the bear?
Yeah.
Do they, like, have it taxidermied?
Taxidermied, yeah.
So she doesn't live down the road, technically.
Well, she dies down the road, I guess.
Where is the cocaine bear?
I think they get it at the Kentucky for Kentucky.
Really?
Kia shop.
Interesting. Or so, anyways, the... and then Drew Thornton bailed on the plane, and it crashed into a mountainside in, like, North Carolina or something like that. And then he died. There's a lot of speculation as to how he died. Again, the official autopsy report is that the massive cocaine bags he had with him, one of them swung up and hit him in the face and knocked him unconscious. And
he fell out.
And then he wasn't able to deploy his bag. However... He was notoriously like perfectionist. He had jumped over 300 times or something. Like, he was a expert paratrooper. Yeah. Like, the fact that he would have died this way is very strange.
Very sus.
But anyways, that's where this the whole thing kind of starts to open. That's where it opens up. Like, what was this? Like, why were so many people? Why was this guy bringing this much cocaine into the United States? Like, what happened? And so, this is one of Sally Denton's biggest errors. She really relies way too heavily on one source, and it's this detective at the Kentucky State Police named Ralph Ross. And he was basically like, you know, in Heat, there's Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. This guy was like the Al Pacino to Drew Thornton's Robert De Niro. They were like... They
frenemies.
They even like met at a bar one time. Like, you know, I'm gonna take you down. This kind of stuff, or at least Ralph Ross says they did.
Ralph Ross probably saw Heat.
You probably
right. Yeah. It's like, well, I don't know. It might have been that.
Well, Ralph Ross actually was arrested, and I don't know if he saw jail time for it, but for illegal wiretapping, he was kind of set up. It does sound like he was kind of set up. Anyways, so what Drew Thornton was a part of was this thing called The Company. And in Bluegrass Sons, Aaron Chandler interviews Drew Thornton's right-hand guy, this guy named Bradley Bryant, who is her uncle, Aaron Chandler's uncle. So Bradley Bryant and Drew Thornton ran this thing called, quote-unquote, The Company. But in Bluegrass Sons, Bradley Bryant is like, there was never anything called The Company, even though that, like, he openly admits they had a thing together. But it's like, that's what I'm saying. It's kind of he's intentionally kind of trying to do a limited hangout. Like, there's something there, but there's not. Like, the classic spy thing, if you've ever seen Mirage Men.
The classic
spy thing of, like, trying to simultaneously hip you to the scent and then throw you off of it to like, put you in this wilderness.
A little bit
of mirrors thing. Yeah, to make you very disoriented and confused, essentially.
Yeah.
But So the origins of what is called the Bluegrass Conspiracy started with these guys who all grew up together and ran around together. Bradley Bryant, Drew Thornton, this guy named Mike Kelly, I think Jack Lambert, this guy Henry Vance, and they were all, like, Henry Vance was an aide to Bobby Richardson, who was the Speaker of the Kentucky House for a while. All these people were deep into Kentucky Democratic politics. Yeah. Like, they had connections with Governor John Y. Brown Jr., who, you know, made his millions off KFC chicken.
Briefly on the Boston Celtics.
Yeah. Yeah, he was governor. He won. He actually beat Hal Rogers and Louis Nunn in 1979 for governor. Yeah. But these guys in Bluegrass, so she doesn't get into this in Bluegrass Conspiracy because she wouldn't have known this. And this is an interesting part of Bluegrass Sons, but again, raises more questions that aren't answered. But Drew Thornton and Bradley Bryant met with CIA operatives in like 1969 or 70, and in a motel outside of Cincinnati. And it's never explained who set them up. It's Drew Thornton's the one that like brought Bradley Bryant.
Who their point person was.
Yes, never explained. That's why it's so fucking maddening and frustrating. Right. But like, they met with CIA operatives, and if you are able to like kind of like piece together what happened, and I think Douglas Valentine even says this in her book. Which is fascinating that she printed it. He's basically like, don't listen to your uncle. He's a lying piece of shit. He's a fucking, like, he's a spook. He's a spy. Like, he's going to lie to you. Yeah. These guys were doing covert.
Valentine kept it a buck.
He did. He was like, he's like, these guys are covert operatives, and they were tasked with bringing in drugs in an attempt to do several things. They were trying to steal Soviet spy equipment and raise funds to do it. And in order to do that, they had to bring in massive amounts of drugs. But they were also, more than anything, gun runners. They were funneling massive amounts of drug profits into gun running, gun smuggling, yeah, to the Contras.
Yeah.
Like, and so, it's interesting. Like, I found this book at Half Price Books called The Cornbread Mafia.
Yeah.
About this guy, written by this guy, Joe Keith Bickett, and I've friended him on Instagram, and I'm trying to get him. I wanted to see if I can interview him. But he was a part of the Cornbread Mafia in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. And like, I was reading his memoir, and he's like, we didn't go anywhere near those guys, Drew Thornton and the company. Like, everybody knew they were
connected to the
feds. Yeah, they were all feds. They were all like feds and rats and snitches. Yeah. And also, those guys were all farmers. Like, they were growing weed in Kentucky. Whereas, like, the company, the Bluegrass Conspiracy guys, were bringing weed in through... Their biggest clients were the Medellin cartel, basically.
Yeah.
And,
Wait, the company or the Bluegrass?
The company.
Okay.
The Bluegrass... Which is the Bluegrass Conspiracy.
No, I'm talking over the Cornbread Mafia.
The Cornbread Mafia guys, they were growing their own weed.
Okay, that was just... They were one-stop shop there.
Yeah.
They controlled the whole means
vertical,
of production.
Vertical, yeah. They were growing their own weed in, like, Kansas, Kentucky, fucking Minnesota, all that kind of shit.
Yeah.
Johnny Boone, right?
Johnny Boone, yeah.
But anyways, these guys... The Bluegrass Conspiracy guys, the company guys. Sally Denton gets into it towards the end of the book, but what this was a CIA front run within the DEA called... It started out as something called Operation Bunsen, and then it became Operation Deacon. And it was started by this guy named Lucian Conan, who was Edward Lansdale's right-hand man. Edward Lansdale was like the... Both of them, actually. Lucian Conan was responsible for the assassination of... what is his name? Ngo Dinh Diem, the South Vietnamese president or whatever in 1963.
Oh, he organized that hit.
Yeah. And Edward Lansdale was the guy that Graham Greene based The Quiet American on. Like,
huh.
These were like covert ops,
high level,
like fucking Phoenix program.
Company man.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. But Lucian Conan was the one that started this program, and essentially what they were doing was at the same time that they were bringing crack into like urban black neighborhoods, they were flooding the South with weed and cocaine.
Yeah.
Because it was all part of the same basic logistical structure, which was they were just bringing massive amounts of drugs into the United States and funneling the funds back into anti-communist militias like the Contras, essentially. But it is crazy because...
I mean, that's hilarious that we're launching new drug wars as it's like to the degree that there is, you know, and I'm not saying that like if, you know, independent of all the Cold War fallout, there wouldn't be like drugs in America. But to the fact, like, we became the world's largest narco state essentially because of anti-communist.
100%, dude. Yeah. There's a book called The Politics of Heroin, CIA Complicity in the Drug War, I think is what it's called, by Alfred McCoy. And that book really gets into it because, in the wake of World War II, like the global heroin trade and heroin use in the United States drastically declined during World War II because, I mean, for a number of reasons, but like there were basically like embargo conditions put on the United States where nothing was even getting in, including heroin, but also just global trade in general severely contracted during those years. And a significant amount of drug networks and like racketeering networks that would have been able to traffic in drugs were suppressed or just flat out like fucking killed or eradicated through the fighting. But in the wake of World War II, we literally restarted the global heroin trade, really because, I mean, I don't know, you probably already know this, but like we... like Lucky Luciano, right? Like the mafia guy in New York, like they deported him back to Italy to help in the invasion of Sicily in Italy during World War II.
Oh, in fact, when U.S. troops showed up there, they unfurled not the U.S. flag, but the big purple flag with the L on it for Lucky Luciano.
Yes, exactly, right. Yes, exactly. And so like they, and the reason being was because like drug warlords are generally good anti-communist forces. Yeah. And so, like, you know, and the history of, like, using heroin to wage imperial wars is pretty long, right? Because, like, the Brits did this in China with, like, the Opium Wars. Like, opium addiction was non-existent in China prior to, like, the 19th century. And then after that, like, it skyrockets because they fucking, you know, flooded that area with smokable opium, which was a new thing. And so then that's when you get like the rise of like the Golden Triangle in like Burma or whatever, this area of like high opium poppy production.
Yeah. Southeast Asia.
I mean like the global trade in heroin and cocaine would have been impossible without, you know, the imperialism of the capitalist world in the 20th century.
What is the tie-ins with like, because aren't there like tie-ins to what's his face? God damn it! Help me out. His nephew was dating Princess Diana. Dodi Al-Fayed.
Oh yeah, Dodi Al-Fayed.
But they figure into this, right?
Well, they were arms dealers, I'm pretty sure. Weren't they, like, part of the BCCI, the Pakistani bank that funded the opium trade in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, as it relates to the Bluegrass Conspiracy, wasn't Lexington PD at one point, like, training?
Oh, well, she doesn't talk about it in that book, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Because, like, something I keep coming back to over and over again during, like, the Bluegrass Conspiracy is, like, why Lexington? Mm-hmm. Of all the fucking places in the United States, like the Eastern United States, why Lexington? There's a few reasons for it. One is the geographical convenience. It's like perfectly situated between like the North and South, like on the mid.
It's like an 8-hour, like a day's drive to a lot of places.
Right. But another is honestly, a big part of it is the legacy of Covington and Newport.
Like, it's kind of a mafia stronghold
there. Yeah, before 1960, that was the biggest gambling area in the United States, and yeah. It was mobbed the fuck up. And then once they drove the mafia out of that area, they all went to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
This is the same time that Dan Chandler went to Las Vegas. That was Happy Chandler's son, Aaron Chandler's dad.
To run
Caesar's Palace.
Caesar, yeah.
And his biggest clients were the Chagra brothers, who were like the biggest weed and coke importers in the Southwest in the 70s and 80s, and who famously, I guess allegedly, hired Woody Harrelson's dad to fucking smoke Maximum John Wood, the federal judge in Texas, which is crazy that like there's that connection,
yeah,
and that goes all the way into Kentucky. Which
Woody Harrelson, I think, went to high school in Cincinnati, in like suburban Cincinnati.
Oh, interesting.
Like, he's from Texas originally, but
yeah,
went to high school in suburban Cincinnati, so he was familiar with the
interesting
area. Yeah,
yeah. But like, I guess the point here is that the people talk about like the imperial boomerang or whatever, like it's been returning to the United States for a long time in the form of drugs, basically. And then specifically, you know, in the 80s and 90s is when you get this, like, I guess you could say that there are probably several phases of this. Like in the 40s and 50s, you've got the federal government very militaristically and strictly, you know, clamping down on drugs and drug trafficking in America. In the 60s and 70s, they kind of start doing the opposite. They start trying to run these programs that you would see in other areas, primarily because, well, I don't know if you could like say this confidently, but I do think a big part of it is they were trying to encourage drug use among like the hippies and whatnot. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very controversial.
Yeah.
Thing, but regardless, they had switched to a policy of using American drug markets and consumers as revenue sources for funding Contra like activities around the globe, whereas that was not the case in the 40s and 50s. Definitely started to become the case in the 60s and 70s, and then even in the 80s, right? Because like Iran-Contra was in the mid 80s, and like those guys, those bluegrass conspiracy guys, were involved in that. Drew Thornton,
uh-huh,
he was going down to Central America, to Nicaragua, all these areas, and hanging out
with right-wing death squads,
hanging out with the Contras and whatnot. And this is another good thing, and I will give her credit about this in that Bluegrass Sons book. Like she admits, like these guys had all been groomed and programmed, that's her word,
yeah,
from an early age to be these types of people who, yeah, would run, who would basically be kind of just like robotic psychopaths, basically. Yeah. But also chimeras, like people who you couldn't get a read on necessarily. They were like always trying to throw you off the scent.
Yeah, yeah.
They were groomed and programmed from a young age to be the type of people who would be willing to smuggle massive amounts of drugs into the, yeah, country in the name of patriotism or whatever to, yeah, fight anti-communism globally.
Do you think they really believe that? Do you think they were just...
I think it's like she interviews, and this is the thing, because she interviews her uncle, Bradley Bryan, in this book, and you can tell he's got some bit of regret and remorse about it, but at the same time, he's just got this mental backstop that doesn't allow him to fully come to that conclusion. Like, you can tell that in his mind, it was all in service of the country, and therefore, like, this guy even went to fucking prison for, like, 3 years.
So he's compartmentalized. He's like, no, I did this for my country.
Yes, and yeah.
Really, truly.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, like, very disturbing.
Yeah.
He went to prison for 3 years because him and his cousin broke into the China Lake Naval Facility in California and stole naval scopes, or sea scopes or night scopes, that they were going to sell to the Libyans for Soviet radar.
Just one of those fraternity initiation rituals y'all time reading about, you know?
Yeah. And people at the time were like, how's this guy get into a fucking naval facility?
Yeah, that's a damn good question.
Well, if you're mobbed up...
you got ways.
Yeah. Or not mobbed up, but... what would be the word?
Connected to
fetted up?
Yeah, connected to intelligence.
I don't know, man. It's just, it's a very weird thing. And the whole story is so murky that it's hard to even like get a good sense on the whole picture, the holistic picture. Because like where this started for me was like I was trying to piece together this story of like, could you do a story about the history of drug use in Kentucky? And unfortunately, telling that story is marred because a huge chapter of it is, like I said, it's kind of like distorted and warped because of the Bluegrass Conspiracy.
Yeah.
Like so much of that, what happened there is like...
Like the Bluegrass Conspiracy's existence and like just kind of relying on like cops who are not famously reliable narrators.
Yeah.
Typically. And also like in the case of this, the... Bluegrass Sons, you know, relying on the word of intelligence related,
yeah,
snitch, you know, and so forth. It's like it kind of creates a yeah, like it just kind of muddies the picture as a whole, and like people are so like wedded to the Bluegrass Conspiracy stuff that like they can't see the deficits in it because, you know, like it's made Cocaine Bear and all that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah. Earlier, you mentioned the Lexington police. That was another reason, like, asking why Lexington? The Lexington police were basically, they were one of the most corrupt police forces, like, you know, in the eastern U.S. This guy named John Bizak was a detective for them, and he was obviously working with the company to, like, yeah, cover up murders. And he went on to be, like, state commissioner of police under... Paul Patton.
Paul Patton. That makes sense, yeah.
And that guy...
Who was shortlisted to be Bill Clinton's vice president.
Yeah. Well, all these guys, they're all... Okay, and this is where you start to get into the dialectics of all this. Because all these guys were pretty much connected to the Kentucky Democratic Party machine. The Kentucky Democratic Party had basically run the state all throughout the 20th century,
yeah,
with the exception of like three governors.
Yeah.
You know, Louis Nunn was one of them in the 60s. There was a famous, I don't know if you ever knew this. I didn't even know this until recently. Like William Goebel, that was his name.
Oh yeah.
Goebel.
Yeah. Spelled like
Goebel.
The singular version of Goebel.
They basically tried to steal the election in like 1899, and
who stopped the steal?
A bunch of Republican armed militiamen who came from the mountains of eastern Kentucky and descended on Frankfort and assassinated Goebel.
So that's how that kind of thing used to,
yeah,
get stopped out.
Yeah. So, like, you know, but anyway, suffice it to say, the Democratic Party ran Kentucky for a long time, and it's kind of like old paternalism and old boy networks kind of facilitated the rise of something like the company. And as that started to fall apart in the 80s, and specifically as the Democratic Party started to lose support in Kentucky and start to get the rise of the Republican Party, that's when you get this weird trade-off, this weird switch where, like, the corruption of the Democratic Party in Kentucky kind of dialectically gave rise to a person like Hal Rogers, who would go on to not be involved in the trafficking of drugs, but the opposite, would go on to militaristically clamp down on drugs, which gave rise to the opioid epidemic. So like that's how you get this like chain of events, right? From like conspiracy, cocaine and weed to, you know, Democratic Party to Republican Party to opioids, synthetic opioids.
The through line is it's all about the drugs.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, and the synthetic opioid epidemic is very strange and like in that context. Because the previously, like, opioid use worldwide was through heroin, which is a, you know, grown from a crop, poppy. But it is very strange, and again, only possible in a place like Eastern Kentucky and Appalachia, that you get an opioid epidemic because of the rise of the healthcare industry, because synthetic opioids aren't distributed, at least not at the point of production, through illicit channels. It's all illicit. It's all illegal. Yeah. It's all dumped into, like, formal economic structures, whether they're healthcare institutions or the doctor's office or even pill mills. Those are legal, or were at one point.
They're all licensed, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but then you've got this trade-off where they get introduced into the illicit channels, the legal channels, and then get flooded into the illegal, informal market channels. So it's a very bizarre, unprecedented thing. I mean, I guess it's not totally unprecedented, because heroin use in the late 19th century was mostly like a middle class white woman thing, white ladies in like disaffected
Xanax wine.
Yeah, in the 1890s, they were the biggest users of heroin and morphine. And they were mostly they got them from what were the equivalent of pill mill doctors, you know, people just over prescribing it. And then you get a similar process where through the 1900s and 1910s, through the criminalization of that, this is the thing. Every time you criminalize drug use, you wind up expanding massively the infrastructure and apparatus for illegal and illicit logistics, actors, narcos. So it's like, and I'm not, you know, telling anybody anything they don't already know, but if you just decriminalize drugs worldwide, you would in one fell swoop essentially knock off all the narcos, all the fucking like cartels and fentanyl, whatever. But like, there's a reason we don't do that.
Because
at this point it's so deeply embedded in national security. The CIA needs the cartels, they need the narcos, you know what I mean? The DEA needs that, like, it's even a part of our border regime, right? It's like they're not going to do that.
Now, let me ask you, Terrence, if Venezuela were not a socialist country with massive oil reserves, seems to me like we probably wouldn't be, you know, their favorite little joke, him and fucking Gay D like to say, is like, I wouldn't go fishing off the coast of Venezuela right now.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Come on.
I mean, I got this Apple News alert. America loves cocaine again. A new kingpin is cashing in. How the fentanyl crackdown created a perfect opening for a powerful drug trafficker in Mexico. It's like, dude, that's... like, we love cracking down on drugs only to create new kingpins and cartels.
That's what we've been doing for time immemorial.
And again, it's not even a matter of policy. Like, this is misguided or not wise policy. It's quite literally how the United States empire
works.
Operates. Like, we have to do this at this point. I don't know.
Who's the new guy?
I didn't open it because I don't have a fucking subscription or whatever, because it's in Wall Street Journal. And you can't even fucking pirate their goddamn articles anymore.
Really?
Yeah, dude, they figured out the paywall thing, the paywall trick. Where was I going with that?
The way the U.S. empire works, we have to do this now.
Oh, well, I guess the point I was trying to make there is that, like, if you look at the... If you look at, like I mentioned a second ago, like the imperial boomerang thing, like, fascism has been in the United States, obviously, for a while, but in this specific form that we're seeing it now. And it started in places like Eastern Kentucky with the opioid epidemic, specifically. Like, our long-standing policies and approach to anti-communism by, you know, funding illicit drug networks, using the funds from that to funnel them into anti-communist death squads and whatnot, like, that has now rebounded and returned to America in the form of the synthetic opioid crisis, which is something that you only get with a specific set of historical circumstances, like the decline of coal industry and the decline of just industry in general, and the rise of service and healthcare industries, the rise of, like, policing as a local policing as a form of imperial ideological reproduction. It's just like you only get it in a certain set of circumstances. I don't know. It's very strange. I guess what I'm saying here is that, like, when we talk about, like, the imperial boomerang, it's like, yeah, like, a lot of communities in America have already been experiencing it for a little while. But we just don't see it that way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why do we compartmentalize that? Like, we were talking about, I guess what kicked this off is, like, we live kind of under military occupation, but we just don't view it that way.
Yeah.
Why is that? It's the same thing. It's like, we have all this evidence to... And most people know, mm-hmm. at least, you know, on some level, that there is nefarious narco-related activity at the highest levels of the intelligence community and state in general. But how are we able to separate that and say, no, it's the fentanyl coming across our southern border. It's the South American drug kingpins in mm-hmm. Venezuela. And it's like, why do we, like, weigh those things differently when it's other people versus ourselves?
And that's a good question. I mean, I guess it's like part of it is that it's this long, like, secular trend where people can't, and you can't blame them, because, like, how many of us know actually what the empire does around the world on a daily basis?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
We would have to rely on daily news reports and stuff that most of us don't even have access to.
Well, it's that Ken Klippenstein thing. Like, when you sent me that, when we were talking about Trump's basically gag order on, or given, you know, FBI, ICE, whoever, carte blanche to crack down on anybody that says anything bad about Trump policies.
Yeah.
But in there, I mean, you know, it kind of talks about... like Jimmy Carter had signed something similar, and it was a big national scandal. Not something similar in terms of, like, what was in the executive order, but these types of executive orders that give
right
the to police state,
yeah,
like, you know, get out of jail free card to crack down however they need to. And, like, when it was revealed later on, I guess the other big one he talks about in there is, like, George Bush's NSA stuff,
right?
You know, Patriot Act stuff, wiretapping, all that kind of thing, post 9/11. Like, those were big scandals, but, like, we didn't really know the full scope of them until later on. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But part of it is that, like, you've got this paradigm of rights that everybody theoretically has, but as you roll it back, as I've said this before, you've kind of got just, like, the ghost form of it. And so how do you actually, like, resurrect that and make it something meaningful? Because the way people rationally deduce that is, like, yeah, if the road that led you here, what good is the road or whatever? It's like, if we had rights, but now we don't have them, like, what good were the rights? It becomes this,
what,
like,
good were the rights?
It becomes this weird kind of, like, teleological thing or anti-teleological thing where it's like you've not really seen it work for you in any meaningful way. And so you kind of are able to just abstract it or throw your hands up and be like, well, it's just, this is the way it's going.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I mean, I guess where the point of intervention comes in that kind of dialectic between, you know, one battle after another, like, it never ending for either side, really. Mm. Like, it'll never be total victory for the fascists. And we'll always be fighting the fascists, yeah, basically.
Yeah. It's kind of true. It is like, it does present a kind of an issue where it's like, if we got our way and we just, like, crack down on them in the same way,
uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It would feel very antithetical to our, like, initial purpose, you know what I mean? Which kicks the door open a little bit for them to slide right in there and, like, the you know, it's
the funny thing is, like, we wouldn't even have to, like, crack down on them, like
the key is to present a world and a vision executed in such a way that most people want to live under that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's for the warts of the Soviet Union happened when it got a little, well, there's a lot of reasons for the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot having to do with US empire. But I think, like, the objective is to present a mode of living that people just don't want to live under anything else.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That it's going to be so sweepingly popular. That's why we seesaw between this tepid liberal shit and this tepid right-wing shit, which is now going into extremism, to use their term, is like nobody wants to live under either of these competing visions. But for some reason, we just can't get outside. We can't conceive of anything else or how to like mobilize enough people. Part of that has to do with demographics. We're just a big-ass country. It's hard to herd cats. But nobody wants to live under either vision of like what these parties have set forth.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
So. I guess it's like a substantial portion of the right wing, or not a substantial, an insubstantial portion of the American population, but they are substantial enough to sway right wing politics. Like, I guess they want it, but like, it's a very small amount relative to the larger.
But I would venture to say, Trump never had a rally that ever approached anything close to some of Bernie's bigger rallies, for example.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what I mean?
And I was making this point on the, I know this might sound really lib-brained, and I'm really sorry, but I was making this point on the main episode a few days ago. But like, it's just kind of striking how there is broad support for, you know, a constellation of left-wing policies, like everything from free healthcare to abortion access to unions, you know, anti-right to work laws, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Most people want those things. Separation of church and state, all these things.
Most people want those things, yeah. But a small subset of ignorant swamp scum got to rule the Republican Party and are now in power.
Yeah.
On policies that nobody wanted except like a handful of the worst people you've ever met. You know what I mean?
I mean, I do think a large part of it, though, is reflective of how political economy is increasingly structured. Like, I don't know how quite to thread this needle, and I don't even know if I really believe this or not. So, like, don't quote me on this. But I saw this thing about how Trump is, like, so, for example, like have you seen the graphs about how like soybean production in America has completely fallen off?
It's just totally collapsed, and it's like, yeah.
I mean, like, which it started under Biden, I think, but like it's, you know,
and now hit a critical point under Trump.
Yeah, and it's pretty much because
what
of
was
the
deal? Is it the tariffs on top? Like, was it China one of the biggest buyers of our soybeans, and now?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of. Our buddy Joe was explaining this to me, that like soy is not just like a human dietary staple. It's a lot of it is used in our dog food.
Yeah.
You know, the cat food. But like, you know, I saw something today. Hold on. Bear with me for just a second as I find the piece of evidence to back up my theory.
My outlandish claims. This movie's so sick.
It's so tight, dude. Outstanding. Boy, you turned me up. Alright, I must not have saved it. So, I guess I'm just gonna have to not.
My God.
The point being is that the cost of everyday things in this country is going up, primarily because we're deporting so many, you know, of our racialized underclass, right? Yeah. And so I do kind of wonder if part of the reason, and I don't know if it's a conscious one, but maybe it's more one of those subconscious, goes back into the sort of cosmic ether of collective ideology. It almost makes me wonder if them sending in the troops to various cities is part of a larger movement to essentially get American labor to the point that the racialized underclass is at. And by that I mean deprived of any rights and stability whatsoever, that it's more easily exploitable and therefore cheaper.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's like they're trying to make American labor cheaper by brutalizing it constantly and stripping it of any rights. Basically, treating it in the same way that it already treats like the migrant racialized underclass.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how bottom of the barrel things are. Like, we should have been standing up for the rights of those people, But we didn't.
It really is the first they came for.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, on a broader scale. Yeah.
And so I guess my point is like, I don't even know if they're even doing that subconsciously or if they know that's the reason why they're doing it or if that even is the reason why they're doing it.
That's definitely an intended consequence or unintended.
Right, for sure. All of which is to say, though, that like, I think that's a. I don't know how you fucking put that back in. I don't know how you put that back in the bottle, right? Like, I don't know how you put that genie back in the bottle, because it's like, once that's out, like, you can have all the Bernies and Mamdanis run as you want, but like, unless they're actually confrontational to the elite class, unless they're willing to put Bill Ackman in fucking public stocks, I just don't know how you're going to get out of that situation, because that is a long-term secular spiraling trend that is not going to stop just by raising a few taxes.
Yeah.
You're going to have to do several things, but you're going to have to like militarily occupy most red states. But you're going to have to do it in a way that's like not really that mean. Like, you want to at least make sure that like people can still farm and grow crops and like get money doing it.
There's a lot of needles they have to thread.
And
I'm going to be honest with you, Trump is not a needle threading guy.
Yeah,
he's an ostentatious.
Well, I'm talking about
fat
like,
gay house cat.
I'm talking about like the progressive left, like AOC. No.
I know what you're saying.
Like, I don't think that like you're also going to have to abolish ICE. You're going to have to, like, dismantle that whole military-industrial complex.
You're going to be willing to yeah, I mean, they're not going to be in political assassinations, but you're going to be willing to throw some people in jail and make sure they stay there.
Yeah, dude. You're going to have to bust up the entire Proud Boy paramilitary block and everyone associated with them in your right. Put Stephen Miller.
Probably debathification of the military.
Yeah.
You know?
Probably. I mean, that's a problem that's, like, deep-reaching, and it's what I'm, like, I think this is a big reason why the piss is gone, at least as it pertains to Democrats, because they can't, some of them, I think, know what needs to be done, but they can't, like, quite commit themselves to that, because, shit, dude, who would? Like, you would need someone with some singular vision and courage, basically an Abe Lincoln like courage to basically, and I don't know if anybody, you're already seeing like Mamdani have to, you know, backtrack on a few things, and like I'm not like invalidating the whole thing, I'm not like trying to like throw a wet blanket on it, but it's just
like it's telling that like you have to walk that line sometimes.
You have to.
Yeah, and I hope it's a situation of when he gets in there. I mean, it looks like he's going to, even though it looks like they're trying to rat fuck him now, but pulling Adams out.
Adams,
they're trying to Bernie kneecap his ass.
Well, yeah, they are.
But yeah,
but, and I should say I want him to win, and we'll try to get him to win if push comes to shove. Yeah. But yes, he's already backtracking on some things, which you have to. I mean, that's the
nature of the empire.
That's the nature of the empire, but. Yeah. Man, I don't know, man.
Well,
sorry to get us into this doomer spot. I'm telling you, dude, it's post-surgery depression. I brought a joint. I have not smoked since I had surgery.
Have they told you not to?
They said don't blow through my nose.
Don't blow it out your nose?
Don't blow it out my nose, yeah. But I can blow it out my mouth.
The doctor came in there and said, hey, smoke up, Johnny, but not through your nose.
I asked him specifically. I was like, "Can I smoke weed?" And he was like,
"Officially, no."
I said, "Not to admit to any illegal activity, but can I smoke marijuana?" He goes, "First of all, weed is legal in most states. Second of all, just don't blow it out your nose."
He turned to all of us and says, "Hey, we got a cool guy in here. Says he likes to smoke pot."
But I was like, I don't know how this episode is going to go today. It's probably going to be a bummer. So I brought a joint just as a parachute, as like a ripcord if this got too bad.
Well, you can always hit it, man. it's one of those things like having a Xanax in your pocket. Even if you don't take it, just knowing you got the option
mm-hmm.
helps.
Knowing you've got the option.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude.
Dude, this movie gives me such.
I'm telling you, this
sweaty palms.
This scene, the bridge scene, the riverbed was dry. That cost them millions of dollars to do this one scene. And hey, money well spent, in my opinion. This is one of the best scenes in any movie ever made.
Yeah.
Incredible. Masterclass. I love this shit.
Damn. See, that's right where I would have been. I'd have tumbled right in the damn creek.
Uh-huh. Me too. I'd be fucked.
Yeah.
All right, what time is it? 1 o'clock. All right, sorry for the bummer of an episode, everybody. I'll be funny again someday. Dude, I've really convinced myself I have the yips. I've convinced myself that surgery gave me the yips.
That's fine. You'll shake the rust off in no time. That ain't even no rust. It's just things ain't real good right now.
Yeah. I just wish things weren't so bad.
We should have just stayed talking about Hawks on the ancient craft of necromancy or whatever it's called.
Fuck, you're right, dude. What are you doing?
We just stayed there. We didn't even talk about the rapture.
Dude, we did.
The rapture came and went.
It came and went.
We didn't even talk about it.
Here's my thing about the rapture. You would think at this point that there have been so many... We're gonna do like toe clasps.
But no, I go this way.
You would think that at this point there have been so many missed calls in the rapture that like you would just stop making.
It's one of those
predictions.
It's high risk, not a lot of reward.
Man. Yeah,
because if it does happen, then it's like.
But I guess
nobody's gonna be around for you to be like, I called it. See,
yeah,
I called it.
True. Then again, I guess it is kind of. It is kind of low risk in the sense that, like, does anybody ever really fall away after a false rapture? Seems like everyone just doubles down and becomes even more insane.
Well, something I've noticed, and this is disconcerting, is every racist young white man in America has a Bible verse in his bio.
Yeah.
In his bio.
Yeah.
Usually something out of 1 Timothy.
Why is that?
I don't know. Curious. But... that's a bad trend.
Yeah.
That's a bad trend. This is why, honestly, Islam's the only Abrahamic religion left that's not cooked.
Well, they're serious, at least. Yeah. I mean, I've said this before, but, like, but I know it's generally considered a marker of provincialism, backwards savagery, when they killed the Charlie Hebdo people, but like, at least it sent a message,
a strong message,
which is don't fucking portray the Prophet Muhammad.
There's only a handful of things.
They don't fuck around with that. Whereas yeah. Christians,
too fast and
they're not about that life, dude. They'll let Christ be portrayed in any like crazy crypto NFT bobbleheads, like they don't fucking
skateboard.
Yeah, dude, it's
Jesus
like,
is my homeboy.
Jesus means nothing to them.
Nah,
so it's like
he's just a marketing tool.
Yeah,
that's the truth, man. Us Christians and Jews, we've let a critical mass of shitheads in.
Yep,
and we've let it tilt too far in the other direction. Gotta
yep.
start from the top. That's why I say here today. I'm not gonna play.
No, come on. Are you going to start a new religion?
No.
Or are you going to denounce the false prophets and haters?
Well, they denounce themselves.
Are you gonna denounce Erica Kirk?
I've already denounced her. What else was there to denounce?
I love how people look. I'm as annoyed as they come, but I don't think there's anything nefarious about her. Basically, like. Smiling ear to ear every time she appears in public after her husband was blown away. I think it's just because she was married to Charlie Kirk and now she's not anymore, which has got to be one of the best feelings ever.
Honestly, and you didn't have to do it yourself. You know what I mean? She got bailed out.
She was like, fuck yeah.
She got bailed out, yeah. Fuck yeah, I could end this charade. And also... use it to you know, here's the thing, and this is something this is one of the more unsavory things I've noticed in a lot of people is a lot of people will milk their grief for attention.
Yeah,
And to her defense, she doesn't seem to be milking the grief, really, for her attention. She seems just downright happy that it happened. You know?
That's true. Although she did...
Maybe for a few days there was some milking.
Well, there were a few like emails where it's like, my husband's body ain't even cold yet, and they're already.
And my husband's body ain't even cold yet, and my daughter's middle school teacher made her take the Shahada. Charlie's been dead 72 hours, and now my daughter's Muslim. Because of DEI. My husband DIE'd, and now my daughter's DEI'd.
That, dude, you can't say it. You couldn't say it at the time, or else you'd go to solitary confinement for 8,000 years. But do you remember?
They just kind of came off it real quick, too, though.
Just the sheer joy of being like, oh, fuck, he's dead. You couldn't say it in public because, yeah, they would knock down your door and fucking...
You know, it's like that is one weird thing about the Trump era is like their biggest fash moments, they just have such whiplash.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it's just because they realize that most people are rejecting that stuff, but like he still has to feel like the special boy by doing all the executive orders and all the horseshit. Yeah. You know what I mean? But it is like they're like, if you take Charlie's name in vain, you'll be beheaded by 10 ICE agents at high noon in the town square. Uh-huh. And now they're just like, we're on to the next thing.
Well, I don't know. I think they used the Charlie Kirk thing to press that directive, national security directive we were just talking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. That is true, I guess.
And they're going to put him on a quarter, probably, which would be really funny.
If he ends up on a goddamn quarter... America's beyond cooked.
I'd say we're already beyond cooked.
No, Terrence. If you put a carnival barker like Charlie Kirk on a fucking quarter, it's not even gone. We're in piss debt.
We
had to borrow piss to pay Paul.
I was borrowing piss to pay Paul. I was talking to my brother about this the other night. You are spot on that the level of bitch acidness is unbelievable. Yeah. Like, get a fucking hold of yourselves. Like, yeah. Crying, people crying. Because I hope my brother doesn't get in trouble for saying this. Or wait, I'll edit out who told me this. Yeah. But he was telling me, somebody was telling me that one of his coworkers took off work the day after Charlie Kirk was killed.
Honestly, I wish I'd have thought of that.
He told his boss that one of his friends died.
One of my friends was shot through the throat with a 30-06 on camera.
It's just like, okay.
In Utah.
I guess you're right. Take the day off. But the levels of bitch ass, like, get a hold of yourself.
I'm so dialed into who these guys are, though. If I were their boss, I would just look at him and say... JF, Charlie Kirk was not your friend. If you think Charlie Kirk was your friend...
A guy who wouldn't think twice if he saw you creamed in traffic by a bus, he would just look and go, oh, just keep walking. Yeah. Wouldn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
What the levels of bitch acidness, like...
The male loneliness epidemic? Yeah, part of it's about not getting a yes, but part of it's also about, like, you think your best friend's a guy on TV. That was lobbying for black chattel slavery to be brought back in the fashion.
Jesus.
That's what it is. It's like you're idolizing guys that don't even know you and don't care about you that are advocating for the most antisocial policies. That's why you're lonely, is because you basically worship antisocial behavior and ideology and the figureheads therein.
Uh-huh.
Because you think somebody's tough or something. Yeah. Or he shows up to UFC fights, so he's just like me. That's another thing. Goddamn UFC fights.
It is wild that they're doing...
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not trying to be like a respectability person, and I like watching UFC sometimes. Yeah. But the majority of Americans,
it's not the UFC. It's I like blood sport too as much as the next round.
Yeah, American I'm a fucking man. Weirdo. I kind of like that stuff.
But the other part, yeah, I paid money to watch a man have a seizure in the octagon one time. It's not that. It's what it portends for society.
Yeah, if the government is embracing it wholeheartedly, and I guess football is also blood sport, so you can't take this too far. But like,
they have the Blue Angels fly over every fucking Super Bowl,
right? But I guess I was thinking about this yesterday. Like you were saying that more people watch tennis.
Jacob Backrad pointed that out.
And I was telling my partner that, and she was like, "Interesting, that's really crazy." And I was like, "Well, it actually makes sense when you think about it, because I think the vast majority of Americans still just aren't comfortable with blood sport." Like, why would they be?
Like, it is a paradox. It's like we live in the most violent nation you could ever drum up.
Uh-huh.
It's like the thing we've talked about. Like, we live under military occupation, yet we don't see it that way.
Yeah,
we live we're governed by lame narco traffickers, but we don't see it that way.
Uh-huh.
And like, we're also extremely violent, but we don't see it that way.
Uh-huh. I don't know. It's like, I guess we've just kind of...
We just have shootings every goddamn... We don't even talk about the shooting at the Mormon church. You know, like, we've had shootings every goddamn day, and now we're just like...
Dude, that guy blew up the church with, like, an IED. Like, but also, someone was like, did anyone else notice that Erica Kirk tweeted out, go to church, and then, like, an hour later, a guy blew up a church? Sorry, I'm not trying to laugh about it, but it's like so de rigueur at this point, just like the commonplace.
Well, I mean,
violence.
You might as well laugh about it, because it's like, what? It's not the specific act. It's not anything. It's just that we've become so well adjusted to it that we don't even think anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people in countries that don't have guns, like really worry about us. Like they do. My friends that live all over the world in places that are at, like, they're like, are you not, like, why are you even going, why are you going outside even? That's like, well.
That's where the air is.
Yeah, it's,
that's where the trees are.
It's like President Donald Trump said on that White House balcony after he got COVID, you can't let things rule your life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the thing is, a lot of this is starting to, I hope a lot of this is starting to click for a lot of people, but like Pete Hegseth, he had this thing over the weekend where it's like, we're going to give the medals back to the like Wounded Knee massacre people.
It's like, dude, it's everything. You know what it is? It's like that Onion meme, Marilyn Manson going door to door trying to shock people. That's all they're doing. That's all they're doing is they're just like, like, what's a historical thing that'll razz the libs up? There. Now let's do something incendiary just to fucking piss them off. That's what it is, because they have viewed the left as having done that to them by just saying, like, we should respect trans rights. Or we should, like, you know, like, whatever.
Yeah, there should
be, you know, equality or whatever.
You should have a general framework of rights that respect human dignity.
Regardless of whatever.
And right, exactly.
Yeah, and they view that as the same affront to them.
Yeah.
As, you know, somebody was saying that something, who did they, some general was on TV saying that, like, the people that wounded me were, like, basically a bunch of drunk, cowardly assholes.
I saw that. Yeah, I remember who said that. But
and, yeah, we're like, which is yeah, true. Which makes sense why Pete Hegseth would, you know,
yeah,
retcon their legacy. Himself a drunk, cowardly asshole.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just seeing that, though, to answer your question, like, why do we not see ourselves as under military occupation and whatnot? It's like, the massacre of natives is so thoroughly, like, internalized and just taken for granted in this country.
Yeah.
That, like, I mean, I even saw people, like, well-meaning liberals being like, this was a shameful episode of an American history, and, like, we shouldn't, which is obviously true. But, like, our existence here continued is shameful.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that, like, oh, we should all, like Eddington, like, flog ourselves. And like
kill ourselves.
Yeah, yeah, like, oh, yeah, like, we don't have no right to talk or whatever. It's that, like, we should be actively working with Native communities to figure out how to
build this all work.
A new United States, yeah, basically. Yeah, 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 yeah. That's, like, centered on, like, ecological value, indigenous ecological values, communism, all this stuff, right? But, no, we're getting Israel 2.0. Yeah. I mean,
I don't know. It's just I just opened my Twitter before I came here and just saw this video of this doctor at a hospital getting sniped in the head by an Israeli drone through a window in his hospital. I mean, it's two fucking years, dude.
Yeah.
2 years this has been going on.
Yeah.
Think about where you were 2 years ago. Imagine if you're a Palestinian who's been living in Gaza. 2 fucking years.
Man, I want to tell you something. We are not far off from that shit happening in the U.S.
It is fuck. I mean, well, they're trying to do it every single day.
Well, that Trump order, like, that's the kind of shit that we're talking about. Like, you know, it starts off as like, oh, FBI can knock at your door, but that's a slippery fucking slope to we'll just send predator drones to your house if you don't worship Trump.
Right.
You know.
And no one's going to do anything about it because, like, we've kind of just...
And because Hakeem Jeffries is all the one thing standing in the way.
Well, I know I've said this, but like,
Apex Shakur is Charlamagne the God referred to him as.
That's good. Yeah, dude. That's really good.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the minute like we let them get away with the global war on terror after 9/11 was when we basically consigned ourselves to
that's
hell.
When we all signed our death warrant, yeah. Essentially. Yeah. Like, as far as like rights and
yeah, thing, absolutely.
And for some people, the actual just literal death.
Literal, yeah, exactly. That's why I don't hold out a whole lot of hope if Trump and them do cancel elections or whatever.
They're going to.
Of course they're going to.
There's going to be no election in 2028. That's not conjecture.
Yeah. I don't hold out.
Or listen, here's what will happen. If they do have an election, here's what election day will be like. Any community that's not voting for them, you're going to have lines wrapped up 5 miles down the road.
Uh-huh.
It's going to be the most extreme voter suppression. And then Trump will get on TV and say... And make no mention of the fact that he suspended the Constitution just to participate in the election to begin with.
Well, yeah, I think this is another reason why I think they're sending in the military to these blue cities. It's like, I think part of it is to have them militarily occupied so that when voting comes around, you'll have an atmosphere of paranoia and fear so deep that nobody will even go out to the polls.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's like they've all but ensured that they'll continue to win.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so, like, if I'm a state like Oregon mm-hmm. or fucking Maine or, you know, New York, like, why even still stay in the union? And I know I'm saying this, which is funny, like, I'm saying this as someone who argued in The Nation that that blue states shouldn't secede. But at this point, what option do you have even?
Yeah.
When I wrote that, like, 6 months ago, like, already the situation was...
It would be hilarious to see like California secede, which wouldn't happen because I mean I just don't think that's going to happen. I don't know.
I'm saying
I don't know. I mean I didn't think you'd have a president that would float the idea of like maybe I'll run again for a third time.
I'm just saying if you want to even have your own elections on your own terms, you might have to secede because already your state is militarily occupied, which means you can't. Even do the basic practices of democracy, which are already a sham, but like liberals love that shit.
Yeah.
Like, so you can't vote. And so even if we do have elections in 2028, you're right. They'll be so suppressed. What's even the point?
Well, you can already see it'll be Trump on TV. Like, by this point, his hands will just be black. And he'll just be like, I won by 97% of the vote.
Yeah.
It'd be the same shit that we pick on, like, a Central American country for or something like
that.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Well, they had an infographic on their Twitter over the weekend that was, like, Trump at 54% approval, which is hilarious. Because, like, if you're going to lie, like, why not just
shoot for the moon? You know what I mean?
It's, like, so classically American to just be, like, you know.
54%.
Dude, his approval is, like, it's 30-something percent.
I thought it was like an 11 at one point.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
We watched almost this entire movie. There's only like 30 minutes left in this movie. I guess that means I should go. I need to go. I hope you've enjoyed us trying to thread these threads. I love how they had the Palestinian guy make a bomb. In Sorcerer, they're like, let's make a Palestinian guy make a bomb. I gotta go, but thanks for listening, everybody. We appreciate your support. Sorry for a bummer episode. I'm going to be funny again. If I could just smoke weed after I've fully recovered from surgery, I think I'll be funny again.
Yeah. You're funny again.
I was never really funny.
Don't worry about it. That's not true. He's fishing for confidence.
No,
here, folks.
Dude,
don't give it to
him. I have the yips. I got the yips bad. I got to get over it.
Oh, God.
I got to get over the yips.
We're going to blow this sky high.
We may not even have a show, though, you know, in 6 months. The drift of things.
That is true. We might be in jail.
We've joked about it, but, like, it just becomes more and more of a reality every day. I mean, you have to assume at this point the FBI listens to this show. Based on the criteria in that national security directive to FBI agents, yeah, they are listening to this program.
Yeah, one of the bullet points in that Ken Klipstein piece, it was like, if you're two gay guys in Kentucky doing a half-ass homespun podcast, it's like, what? That's like got to do with anti-Christianism.
The irony being that we were once Christian, we're the children of mayo-ass genocidal settlers, not children, but descendants. Nah. You know what I mean? Like, everything in that fucking shit. Like,
we flirted with Christian nationalism for a time. As young men.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Go be with God and stuff and have fun and shit. And we'll see you on the main feed in a few days. Peace.
Later.